Thank the Robert Penn Warren Center for the Humanities and the Vanderbilt Institute for Public Policy for inviting me up. It's truly a pleasure to be here. And I'm grateful for the opportunity, and I appreciate all of you coming out this afternoon. To the casual visitor, New Orleans might appear to be a city without relief. And I use relief here in terms of topography, the lay of the land. It looks like an essentially flat surface, except maybe for the levees that border the city on all sides. It also might seem to be a city without relief in terms of the what seemed to be unending summers of heat and humidity. And for those of us who live in the region, it oftentimes seems to be a city without relief in terms of the widespread poverty, which is can be seen on so many quarters of the city. Yet, relief, at least in the sense of topography, matters tremendously in New Orleans. Even though there might be a differential of only 25 feet from the highest point in the city to the lowest, every inch of elevation matters tremendously. And this has profound impacts on the drainage of the city, and this fact has had tremendous impact on the real estate geography, on the social geography, and on the racial geography of this city. And the relationship between race and poverty became particularly pronounced in late August as Hurricane Katrina raced over the lower delta, tossed water from Lake Pontchartrain over the levees and throughout the city, and making the city at least temporarily an embayment, a great giant bay of Lake Pontchartrain. After the storm, we heard countless pronouncements by engineers, climatologists, and hydrologists that their science was right on the mark, that they had predicted storms like this, they knew it was coming, they anticipated, and their predictions about the impact of a storm of this size and caliber and extent were right on the money. But despite their precision modeling and predictions, the media quite clearly exposed a dimension they had not forecast, and that we as humanists were somewhat lacking in terms of helping prepare the city to deal with. And by that I mean the human dimension of such a storm was really overlooked by the science. And this, to my mind, is the real tragedy of Katrina. We may have had tremendous science, but we had woefully inadequate humanities and social science. And I think the media clearly exposed a landscape of suffering, a landscape of tragedy, to use the term of Kenneth Foote. One way that humanists and social scientists have looked at the dealings of human society and hazards from the environment is to look at vulnerability. There's a tremendous amount of interest in recent years, particularly among geographers, as well as others, about in the study of vulnerability. Diana Lieberman has shown that in places like Mexico, the poor tend to be most vulnerable to extreme events, particularly drought. That is, those without resources stockpiled can be harmed most severely when there's inadequate rainfall and crops fail. Georgina Enfield and her team of scholars have looked at how both flood and drought were first felt among the Mexican poor in past centuries. Their work, and the work of a lot of others, is focused on rural areas. But certainly, the vulnerability is not limited to rural areas. And this was all too clearly demonstrated in the weeks that followed Katrina, as we saw tremendous numbers of vulnerable populations coming out of the city. Also, vulnerability is not just a product of biophysical events. It's not just the product of extreme storms, of drought, of flood. Vulnerability is partly the product of social circumstances and social construction of situations that may enhance or accentuate vulnerability. What I want to do here today is talk about both that biophysical vulnerability and social vulnerability, the combination of the two. And first, I want to focus on the physical setting of New Orleans and how vulnerability has been a common part of life in New Orleans for many, many years, and how society has responded to that physical threat of flooding. So I want to talk a little bit about the New Orleans experience, particularly with flooding over the years. When the French arrived in New Orleans, in what became New Orleans in the 1700s, they quite early on passed a colonial law that required every landowner, let me go back one here, they required every landowner to build levees on their property fronting the river. The river was seen as the primary threat because it flooded on a regular basis. Hurricanes came, but were somewhat more erratic and unpredictable. River floods were almost an annual event, and Bienville actually wrote about the fact that they were, in fact, annual events. So the first threat was from river flooding. And oftentimes, the poor found themselves most severely impacted. In 1816, there was a massive flood that flooded the city for about a month. And contemporary chroniclers wrote that inundation has driven many poor from their homes. And standing water was found throughout the city, much of the city. In 1849, there was another major flood, and one of the last really severe river floods to strike the city. The chroniclers then said, the poor are living an aquatic life of privation and suffering. Forced some 12,000 people from their homes and inundated at least 2,000 residences. And flood occupied much of the city for a month and a half. The flooding did not cover this band of land immediately along the river, but the water stood 4 to 6 feet in much of the city. And I apologize for the colors here. This almost looks like some 1950s, one of those 1950s televisions where you put the little plastic acetate over it to make it look like it was a color TV. So just bear with me on the colors. It'll be an exciting afternoon with that in that respect. But the flooding was concentrated in the lowest areas here. So in part, topography shaped those areas of the city that were impacted the most. Because of flooding, as I mentioned before, the colonial law required every landowner to build levees. And the state law later on codified that after every flood, they had to rebuild the levees a foot above the last flood level. So basically, all planning was in response to the last event, not to the next event. Okay, a very fundamental issue here. But by the more or less the middle of the colonial period, levees extended several tens of miles up and down the river on both sides from New Orleans. And New Orleans was not safe until there was a continuous levee system way upstream and way downstream, because the land actually slopes away from the river, and if the levees broke upstream, the water could still come in, as I like to say, from the back door. And by statehood in 1812, the levees ran all the way up to Baton Rouge, which is the first high ground, the first flood-proof area upstream, and all the way up to the Red River on the West Bank, which doesn't have a series of bluffs along the river at all. So the levee system gradually expanded, and the main idea here is that there was a structural response, that is, people responded with engineered works, physical earthen barriers, to try to keep river water out. They relied heavily on these structures, which consistently create a false sense of security. People believe these levees can withstand floods, and ultimately a flood comes along that will exceed their capacity. And this is what I like to call the conspiracy of the levees. There's a conspiracy by the levees to encourage people to move into areas that they might not have lived in without the levees. This structural response made living on the floodplain somewhat safer, but the levees, again, were always prone to flooding. Within the city, a little more detailed look at the city, we can see areas that where there was uneven vulnerability topographically within the city. This darker area is a shoulder of land that parallels and actually runs along both sides of the river, There's what we call the natural levee. It's the area built, literally built by the sediments dropped by the river when it floods. All of New Orleans is built on a floodplain. And they call it a floodplain because the land was physically created by flooding. The flood, when river waters escaped the main channel, they would dump the heavier, coarser grains of sediment immediately adjacent to the river, and that built up a higher swath of land. And this area has ground as much as 15 feet above sea level. They call it nosebleed territory in New Orleans. Okay? It's not very high, but it's the highest land. The area last flooded when there is a flood, and it's the first to drain when there's a flood. Looking at the profile, we see this higher ground immediately adjacent to the river, and the land naturally slopes back away from the river towards an old, ancient river channel, which has its own natural levee, but it's only a fragment of that levee. So this creates a barrier of land. The Metairie Ridge and the Gentilly Ridge create kind of a natural barrier between the city and the lake. And when during the colonial period, when hurricanes came and pushed Lake Pontchartrain water in, this was the only barrier between the city and the lake. And floodwaters would oftentimes pour up through this break in the ridges and cause flooding in the city. But within the city itself is this low area, an area they call the bottom of the bowl. Within this ring is an area below sea level. This is zero contour, 0 feet. It's this low area here. In the 19th century, when there were no levees along the lakefront, this is the area that would flood the longest. It's where the water would collect. And it was the least desirable real estate. And as a result, people with the least means lived here. The well-to-do lived on the natural levee. Those with the most resources, those able to purchase the most expensive property, lived on the natural levee. And those with the least resources were relegated to the least desirable land, which happened to be this bottom of the bowl area. But poverty, more than race, shaped geography of New Orleans. In the 19th century, before the Civil War, many of the African Americans in the city lived on the high ground with their owners. And it was in the 1840s, it was the Irish immigrants who were most likely to be living in these low areas. So poverty, more than race, shaped the early geography of vulnerability in the city. In 1927, well, let me step back just 1 second. Eventually, the federal government took the responsibility of building and maintaining levees away from the local governments. In 1879, Congress created the Mississippi River Commission, which was a federal body, basically part of the Corps of Engineers, with the responsibility for building levees along the river. They raised them from about 4 or 5 feet to about 12 feet high. They built a much more consistent, much more sophisticated levee system, a much more protective levee system. And in 1927, 1926, the Mississippi River Commission announced that they had a levee system that could withstand any flood the river could throw at them. Okay, everybody seems to know what happens in 1927. John Barry has given us the great account of the flood of 1927. And basically, all areas that were on the floodplain were inundated, with the exception of a little area just upstream from New Orleans. The best levees on the river were in this stretch of river between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. But the flood of 27 threatened even those strong and tall levees. The business elite in New Orleans, who long ignored the threat of the flood, finally took cognizance of this impending flood and convinced the President of the United States to allow the Corps of Engineers to blow a hole in the levee to create an artificial crevasse just downstream from New Orleans, here at Carnarvon. This artificial crevasse created a second mouth in the river. One mouth here, a second mouth here. The water drained much faster as a result, and it fell at New Orleans. Because it was moving faster by New Orleans, it actually fell. That may have saved New Orleans. It may not have had any impact. There might not have been a flood in New Orleans anyhow. But New Orleans was not flooded, but this intentional break in the levee created another vulnerable population. There were a large number of Isleño fur trappers who lived in St. Bernard Parish. There was a large number of Dalmatian oyster fishermen who lived in St. Bernard Parish. Their resource base, the oysters and the muskrats, were completely wiped out, and their livelihoods, at least temporarily, were destroyed. This was the richest fur trapping area in the world. More furs were brought in from St. Bernard Parish than Siberia in 1926. So vulnerability was displaced from the largest urban center to a relatively poor neighboring rural population. But it was the regularity of floods and also the topography of this land, the low ground, that created the biophysical vulnerability in the New Orleans area. That meshed with a little intentional flooding of St. Bernard. When we talk about the social dimension of vulnerability, which adds to the unevenness of vulnerability, there's a couple of things that are important to keep in mind. City builders, Lewis Mumford has advised us, oftentimes think of urban places as entities, human constructions that are somehow detached from, separated, removed from nature. That is, they're not subject to the vagaries of rainfall, climate, and all other forms of natural activity. And New Orleans has certainly long traveled a path to try to separate itself from nature, particularly with the levee building. These systems, these engineered systems, are often imperfect, however. And by placing faith in the levees, oftentimes people allow themselves to be lulled into a sense of complacency. And in part, this contributed to the situation in New Orleans. And it's the hubris, the faith in these engineered works that in part created uneven vulnerabilities. The unevenness is particularly accentuated by these structural flood control systems. The levees, for example, as Gilbert White, the foremost hazards geographer, likes to tell us, they create a false sense of security. And whenever levees are built, people rush in behind them to live in areas that they would not have lived in before the levee systems were put in place. And again, we'll see examples of how this occurred in New Orleans. So when these structural systems fail, people pay a much, much higher price. Also, another element lending itself to uneven vulnerability is that wealth, prosperity, can purchase insulation or can buffer individuals from hazardous events. Access to public works, flood-proofing of homes are examples of this. I often like to say that out west there's a saying that water flows towards money. In a water deficit region, those with money can buy water rights and make sure they have a steady access to water. In New Orleans, almost the reverse is true. Money tends to flow away from money. Those with wealth live on the high grounds. They can manipulate and maneuver the construction and public work systems that make sure water flows away from them. If we look at public works projects in New Orleans, the period from 1900 to 1940 was really important in terms of understanding the evolving and changing geography of race in the city, and also access to resources such as public works would minimize vulnerability. In 1900, the city started a major overhaul of its public works program, which involved a new drainage system, a new public water supply system, and a citywide sewerage system. Excuse me. These were all progressive era engineering works designed to serve the entire city, to relieve some of the medical problems, the disease problems that were rampant in the city. And the idea was that the whole city should be served by these progressive, rational engineered works. Yet New Orleans at the time was also a city subject to Jim Crow inclinations and leanings and turmoil. So one of the things I've done with this series of maps here is to look at, kind of try to compare the installation of drainage works with the racial geography to see if there was, in fact, a triumph of progressive engineering over Jim Crow. In 1900, a couple of things stand out. The dark lines, the solid lines here, indicate the drainage system as installed between 1900 and 1910. And what we see here, the earliest phases of public works construction, the effort was to serve the most densely populated part of the city, which included both black and white neighborhoods. The visions here, New Orleans had about 30% African-American population in 1900. So where you have 40%, you're well above the city average. And what I'm trying to do is show areas with considerably more African-American population. But there was no real neglect, at least in the first phase, of any particular area of the city. By 1920, we see several things occurring. One, there's kind of a shift. The African-Americans move, as we say in New Orleans, uptown a bit. We have a greater concentration in this uptown area. The city also had waived connection fees to the water supply so that low-income families didn't have to pay to connect. So they were trying to overcome some of the structural or institutional hindrances that might have occurred in the early installation of this system. But there were some holes that appeared in the bottom of the bowl. This bottom of the bowl there, you see these dashed lines indicate late installation. And this area in the Ninth Ward that has become so famous in recent weeks was late to get some of the drainage system as well. The Ninth Ward was largely Italian at that point in time. But there were also maps that occurred about that time that talk about people of the Italian race. That was the explicit term used. So there was some racialization of the provision of services. We also see in 1923, the city put out a map showing areas that did not have sewerage service, that is, no sewers for household waste yet. The bottom of the bowl stands out, the Ninth Ward stands out, and also this giant area here along the lakefront, which was a brand new area they simply hadn't completed. They weren't able to keep up with the new construction in that neighborhood. But there were some obvious gaps in the system. By 1940, we get the first real clear view of where the African Americans lived in the city, and you can really begin to get some sense of how well those areas were served. Most of the city was served by drainage by 1940. But what stands out here is we have a very definite shift of the African American population to the lower ground. The area immediately adjacent to the river is higher ground. Anything off that natural levee is low ground. This is all low ground. This is low ground. There are a couple of little pockets here on the natural levee, but they're the exception rather than the rule. This one large neighborhood here, what is called Pontchartrain Park, was a newly developed suburb for middle-class African Americans. Okay, we'll talk more about that later. But it's on very low ground as well. The drainage system reached the full city, but the racial geography had shifted considerably. And that means the African Americans were in a position to be more vulnerable to flood events. We also see institutionalized segregation pushing forward with great speed during the 1920s. The lakefront area, which is this area here, most of that area looked like this in 1900. It was a series of houses on stilts, trappers and fishermen who lived on the lakefront, people who made a meager living gathering natural resources. There are also some entertainment districts there. If you ever saw the movie Streetcar Named Desire, when Carl Malden's out dancing on the veranda, they're out at one of these lakefront entertainment dance halls. They were placed there because they got breezes off the lake, and you could kind of escape some of the mosquitoes and heat found in the city. But the lakefront area was basically at sea level, a wetlands marsh in 1900. Between 1920 and 1930, a giant seawall was built 9.5 feet out of the lake. This served as the first flood protection on the lakefront, the first hurricane protection system along the lakefront. And that prompted extensive suburban development in the lakefront. We had massive 1920s era suburbs, many of them having arts and crafts style houses going in. And there was a giant population boom in this area. And this is one of the reasons that area was underserved by sewerage in 1923. It was building rapidly. But most of the homes built in this area and sold during the 20s had deed covenants attached to them. That is, if you bought the house, there were restrictions in the deed that said basically blacks were not allowed to live in these neighborhoods. So there was institutionalized, very explicit racism up until the time that the Supreme Court overturned that real estate practice in the 1950s. So there's very explicit segregation. And then you also, at the same time, you also had the creation of this Pontchartrain Park neighborhood, the one middle-class African-American suburban neighborhood. So you have a swath of development along the lakefront that is very much middle-class, largely white, but one section that's very much an African-American neighborhood. And what's significant about this area and its vulnerability is that once these neighborhoods were drained by that drainage system, and once the lakefront levees kept water from flowing in, the land actually subsided. The land these houses are built on sank anywhere from 2 to 3 feet to as much as 9 feet. You can stand in houses along some of the canals along the lakefront now, and the eaves of the roofs are about at sea level. You can stand at the 17th Street Canal, and if you were standing on the water, you'd look out and you see your head would be at roof level. So this area has actually subsided, and as a result of development, vulnerability has actually increased. Not just the fact that people are close to the water source, but they're actually living below sea level. The vulnerability of the lakefront area and the vulnerability of much of New Orleans, people were not reminded of hurricanes on a regular basis. There was a giant hurricane in 1915 and again in 47. Betsy rolled in after the levees were built along the lakefront in 1965. And the darker area, which is not very easily seen here, Pontchartrain Park, the middle-class African-American neighborhood, endured severe flooding by Betsy. There was also a giant area here, the Zire neighborhood, the Ninth Ward, both lower and upper Ninth Ward, and the Gentilly. Several neighborhoods that were flooded severely by Katrina were also flooded heavily by Betsy in 1965. And this began to expose some of the inequities in housing and the vulnerability, of the uneven vulnerability. Most of the flooding in Betsy was in poor neighborhoods, with the exception of the Pontchartrain Park neighborhood. This prompted a major response from the Corps of Engineers, galvanized public support and congressional support, and millions of dollars have been thrown into an improved hurricane protection system since 1965, a hurricane protection system that was still under construction in August 2005. It was not finished. Many different reasons for the delay, congressional investigations in the 1980s about why it was taking so long. But it was not finished. But what happened was they improved the levees. They raised the height of the levee 17 and a half, 18 feet in some locations. They strengthened the seawalls along the various canals. And they also, this is the Industrial Canal. And in this illustration, this is the same canal. This just shows a giant area of New Orleans East. It was a tremendous area, 40, 50,000 acres of land that was ringed by new levees after 1965. And this became one of the most prominent suburban developments in the city between 1965 and the mid-1980s. This contributed to a major adjustment in population that was also ongoing as there was a major suburban white flight going on in the city. These maps come from the New York Times, and in 1940, again, you can see what I think you saw before, the African Americans were clustered in this low area. By 2000, the black dots indicate African American residences. was a huge sprawl out into this New Orleans East, this new area that had been previously undeveloped. A great sprawl of African Americans into this area what we often call it as gentility. White flight meant a lot of the white residents moved to neighboring Jefferson Parish, which would be off to the west here, or across the lake, or to other parishes, or to the west bank of the river. Between 1940 and 2000, the population changed from about 70% white to almost 70% black in New Orleans. So it was a major conversion in terms of the population. This area, like the other lakefront areas, subsided considerably after construction, and this became one of the great enclaves of middle-class and well-to-do African-Americans in New Orleans, but it's below sea level. One other component of this great adjustment was the single public housing project in New Orleans that was actually on high ground, the St. Thomas Project, was torn down to make way for a Walmart and some high-end condominium development, and most of those residents were relocated to housing projects on much lower ground or dispersed through the city. So there's been a tremendous change between 1940 and 2000, and particularly that has been most pronounced since 1965. The dark area here is the area that's well below sea level. This map has one little mistake here. This is the 17th Street Canal, which gained such notoriety. This is where one of the canal breaks was. The London Avenue was the site of another canal break. Along these canals, there are not the big, massive earthen levees. There's small levees about 4 or 5 feet high, and then those are topped by seawalls, concrete barriers that are about a foot wide, and they're about 8, 9 feet high. These are the portions of the levees that failed on the 17th Street Canal and two sections on the London Avenue Canal. There was another major failure here on the Industrial Canal. Water from Lake Bourne gets blown in and it's guided, it's basically funneled in. There's a levee here and a levee here, and all this water gets funneled into this narrow, what they call Mr. Go, the Mississippi River Gulf outlet. And when it gets into this area, it just popped through the levees in a couple of places. And this caused severe flooding here in the lower Ninth Ward. But there was the lowest area from the 17th Street Canal through New Orleans East was really a mix of African-American and white neighborhoods. Jefferson Parish didn't see much flooding by sheer luck. If the opposite side of the 17th Street Canal had broken, if the west side instead of the east side had broken, Jefferson Parish would have been flooded. Jefferson Parish was the destination of much of the white flight in the post-World War II period. It was important to remember, not just poor neighborhoods were hit. Some of the most severe devastation was in the lower income, lower Ninth Ward, but there were significant areas of both middle class, black and white neighborhoods that were hard hit. Some of the uneven impacts, not just vulnerability, but the actual impacts, were brought about by two things. One, flood-proof construction and mobility. Mobility played a big part of the flood protection planning or lack of planning, and was very important in terms of the unequal impacts. If we look at one area, this is an area called in the bottom of the bowl. This is an area where there was regular flooding produced by rainfall before Katrina. But we have flood-proof housing that endured much less damage in those circumstances and also because of Katrina. You can see this house is a very nice Spanish colonial revival house in the Fountainblow neighborhood built during the 1920s in an area where there was concern about flooding, where there had been regular flooding, so people raised the houses. Hundreds and hundreds of houses in New Orleans built in low-lying areas that are raised like this. This is flood-proof construction. This is what FEMA tells people to do today. Raise your houses. This is a common form built in the 1920s. It takes a little extra capital to do this. In the lower income Girtown neighborhood, which is largely an African American neighborhood right next to Xavier University, you can see the houses are raised up a little bit, 2 or 3 steps up. There's actually air spaces underneath them for cooling. But these houses don't have the flood proofing. Consequently, When Katrina came and filled the bowl up, we see the flood line here, about 3 feet off the ground, but the living space was completely unaffected. Maybe the downstairs basement where the Tulane students lived might have been flooded. But the main residential part was unaffected. In Girtown, by contrast, the same row of houses, you can see, I hope, there's kind of a color change there on this fence. That's the water line. The stain was removed on the lower half, and that's just slightly above floor level. So that meant the entire floors were destroyed, and water would have wicked up into the sheetrock or plaster. So these houses endured much, much more extensive damage because they were not floodproofed. And the absence of floodproofing was far more common in lower-income neighborhoods. Mobility played another part of this ability to weather the storm. This is a 17th Street canal break. Here you can see a bit of one of those concrete walls. The levee broke right here, and it was about 100 yards wide. This house was completely sheared off its foundation by rushing water when the levee failed. The tree, you probably can't tell, but it was a lovely fall, came early to Louisiana. We don't normally have fall color in Louisiana. Everything's evergreen, but here the pine tree has turned bright red as a result of the bracky salt water that came through the levee. But most of the people in the Lakeview neighborhood adjacent to the 17th Street Canal break were able to evacuate. Evacuation moved about 800,000 people out of the city. There were higher numbers of deaths in white neighborhoods, but still the proportion of people who had access to cars and used them was higher in the white and middle class neighborhoods. You can see, hopefully you can see the water line here. Some people had more cars than they could drive out, and these neighborhoods are littered with cars that have been tumbled about. They floated and then they were tossed down by the waters as the waters receded. But the Lakeview neighborhood endured tremendous flooding. Most of the people were able to leave. By contrast, the Lakeview or the Industrial Canal levee break, this is as the water's receding and the water's actually flowing back out of the neighborhood. This area here is about 8 or 9 square block area where more houses were ripped off their foundation here than in the Lakeview. But there were 2 breaks in this levee here and then another one here. The water's actually flowing out of the neighborhoods back into the canal by the time this picture was taken. But I was in this neighborhood, the Bywater neighborhood, 1 week to the day after Hurricane Katrina rolled through. And people were crawling all out of every house in the neighborhood. There were still many people living there. Some cars, even Jaguars, were still parked in front of houses. But far more people chose to stay for whatever reasons. Many of their cars didn't work, or many of them had invalid family members who they were afraid to take out. They didn't have resources to get a hotel room. They didn't have friends out of town that they could stay with. So mobility limited the options to many of the people in the lower income neighborhoods. There was a higher percentage of residents without automobiles in the flooded areas. So the impact was concentrated. And also poverty was higher in the flooded areas. So again, poverty and immobility were a big part in terms of the ultimate impacts. And in parts of the lower Ninth Ward, where there was, like in areas in Lakeview, where there was a tremendous amount of current of water that broke through, there was tremendous destruction. And this is that area immediately below the Industrial Canal levee break, where houses were ripped off their foundations. Katrina didn't blow a single breath of racist wind, but its impacts were most devastating in the African-American neighborhoods. 70% of the nearly 70% of the population in New Orleans is African-American, so they felt the brunt of the storm. Many of them had multiple layers of vulnerability, inability to evacuate, inability to afford floodproof construction, and so on. So relief matters. Topography matters because many of the people who were unable to move were in the low-lying areas. Poverty was concentrated in those areas, and the African-American population was most common in those areas as well. Prosperity obviously could mitigate or minimize the impacts of flooding, the ability of people to floodproof and the ability of people to evacuate. Also, most importantly now, people who have resources and who were able to leave are now able to come back with greater ease. They're able to come back and participate in restoring their houses and participate in the decision making in terms of rebuilding the house. The Lakeview neighborhood reopened about a month after the hurricane. The Lower Ninth Ward only opened just before Christmas, a few days before Christmas. People were kept out. There were National Guard patrols keeping the people out of those neighborhoods. Rebuilding, I think, is going to accentuate some of the pre-existing differences, some of the pre-existing conditions. I think the poor will be obviously slower to return. They'll find an entirely new landscape. They'll find many of the low-skilled jobs taken by a migrant labor force that swarmed into the city. And some neighborhoods that they expect to return to are still going to be cordoned off. They're fighting court battles on when the city can begin bulldozing neighborhoods now. And the city is calling for a neighborhood redevelopment plan that calls for public participation. And those people who are scattered to all 50 states, many of them don't have the ability to come back and participate and take advantage of the experts the city has lined up to help them with redevelopment plans. The New York Times asked last week if a smaller New Orleans will be a wider New Orleans. And I think that's a question that the mayor was certainly addressing last week when he called for his divinely sanctioned Chocolate City. Poor choice of words, but he was basically saying we need to have the presence of all former residents there in more or less equal proportion to what they were before the storm. Rebuilding in New Orleans has a long way to go. It's just in the very, very first stages. And it will be some time before we know the questions to whether or not a smaller New Orleans will be a wider New Orleans and what New Orleans will be. Will it be, as some people are predicting, a Disneyland version of itself? How permanent will the impacts of Katrina be? It will take months, if not years, for us to find the answers to those questions. I thank you.